Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Classic FM. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, country, rock, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com and theaterinparis.com. Question number one, who was the very first rock artist to perform at Yankee Stadium? Was that A, Billy Joel, B, the Beatles, C, Elvis Presley, or D, Nirvana? Safe at first in Yankee Stadium? Who was that anyway? And question number two, what is the most common sound that we, as humans, use without our vocal cords? Is that A, hand clapping, B, foot stomping, C, finger snapping, D, nasal snoring, or E, armpit squeezing? Most common non-vocal human sound. What is that sound anyway? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of June 21st. Well, it was on this day, back in 1948, that Columbia Records began the first mass production of the 33 and a third RPM LP, 1948 today. And it was on this very day, back in 1981, that Mark David Chapman pled guilty to killing John Lennon. Imagine, 43 years ago today. And in classical music news, we have this article titled Classical Fact. This is published in Quarter Notes, 89.7 WSCPE, the Classical Station's Summer 2024 issue. In 1925, Verdi's opera, Aida, about the conflict between love and patriotism in the Egypt of the pharaohs, was performed for a crowd of 20,000 at Yankee Stadium. And in music research and technology, we have this article titled The Sublime and Deeply Therapeutic Joys of Karaoke. This is written by John Metcalf, the Mercury News, published in the News and Observer on the 31st of May, 2024. Karaoke is universal among race, gender, and socioeconomic boundaries. Celebrities such as Jimmy Fallon, Sir Paul McCartney, and Jewel have publicly performed karaoke. The celebrity sightings are a little mundane in the clubs, but nevertheless notable. Most often in these joints, though, you'll find a diverse mix of ordinary folks. Theater workers, part-time musicians, designers, maybe a retired heart surgeon, or Golden Gate, field horse trainer, and public school teachers. So many teachers. It's funny, we get teachers from all around. It's at the beginning of the sessions when school starts, when all these teachers come and get their karaoke in. I used to refer to it as theroki because it was a good de-stressor, said Bethune Daniels, who last year taught a class of kids who grew up during online pandemic education. They really didn't do kindergarten in a real way, and it was just a little chaotic. Karaoke was a good way to break up the week and let off some steam and not have to think about what I was going back to in my classroom the next day. Her husband adds, I would see her up on the stage and all of the stress and all of the pain she'd been carrying from that day would melt off her face, and in that moment she was fully herself. The therapy aspect of karaoke is real. Around 2012, I was not at a good place in life. I was dealing with personal emotional issues and work issues, loneliness and depression and those kind of things, a karaoke jockey from Modesto adds. I wouldn't necessarily say it was a double life, but for me, it lets me disassociate, he said. And without it, I definitely would have as I wouldn't have as deep of a social network as I do now because of those relationships I made during karaoke. So how do people pick their songs? Well, it turns out there can be a complex motivations. It's funny, what I've done before is to get to the karaoke bar early, and I'll choose Radiohead's Creep right away because I know that everyone else wants to sing that one. And I know that if I sing it, no one else can do it for a while. I was a pretty quiet kid when I was younger, and I think music and performing was one of the ways of building up confidence, said an account manager and musician. I like to sing songs that people know because I like to feel the energy in the room. When it's a good crowd, you receive some energy and give some energy back. It just creates a really cool ball of momentum. A nice ball of energy you get rolling through the night with. A lot of older karaoke singers around the San Francisco Bay Area have disappeared. There's a new breed of karaoke singers that have emerged. I noticed them a little before the pandemic. I don't know what drives them. Vocally, in my opinion, they're not as good. You can always tell an old-school karaokeist, even if you have never heard or seen them before. Generally, they have their songs down pat, and the songs they sing are quite polished. Just the other day, I heard some woman singing a Patsy Cline song called Sweet Dreams. It was an elderly woman who just started coming to the Melody Lounge. It was so good, it sent shivers down everyone's spine. That doesn't happen too often. Most of the time, the choice of the song doesn't matter. What matters is that the singer commits fully to the energy of the room. If there's a pie chart of what I like about karaoke, there's a wedge that's your turn to sing, which is really fun. Then there's a wedge that's listening to your friends sing. But the bulk of the pie is that it's socially acceptable to sing along with nearly everything in this community energy of shared music. That's true, even if you can't hold a tune to save your life. Even if you can't sing at all and you put on the song Tequila at the right time of night and sing those three words, people love it. It's great for both you and the audience.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA, then everybody'd be served. Like California, you see them wearing their baggies, Huarache sandals too. A bushy, bushy blonde hairdo, surfing USA.
The Beach Boys, Surfing USA, introduces our rock and pop music news. It's titled Surfing Through Time. It's written by Craig McLean, Radio Times, May 2024 issue. Ahead of a new film about the Beach Boys, band members Bruce Johnson and Mike Love recall the day they stunned the Beatles. It's spring 2024, and I'm at Abbey Road Studios to meet the Beat... Oh, wait a minute. Relax. This isn't more AI gone mad. The Beach Boys. Well, Bruce Johnson and Mike Love, who are in London to promote Disney Plus's new career-spanning documentary about the band, and are holding court at the favorite recording studio of their greatest transatlantic rival. We're meeting 4 days after news broke that the group's troubled creative genius, Brian Wilson, has been placed under a court conservatorship to oversee his personal and medical decisions because of what his doctors call his, quote-unquote, major neurocognitive disorder. But right now, Johnson is recalling happier times, sitting alongside Love in the Fab Four's favored Studio 2. Despite being in their early 80s, their puckish, boyish presences, wearing matching Beach Boys baseball caps, and reflecting on a visit to London in 1966 when they met the Beatles. I came back from dinner with The Who drummer Keith Moon and L.A. music scenester and Johnson schoolmate Kim Fowley said, "You better get upstairs. Lennon and McCartney are waiting for you, and they want you to play them your album, Pet Sounds." This was before Wilson's 36-minute magnum opus had been released in the UK, but rumors of the sonic wonders therein had reached the ears of Britain's 60s musical elite. Luckily, Johnson had a copy of the album with him, so up in his hotel suite, he played it twice to Lennon and McCartney. Later, I found out they basically distilled the vibe of the sweetness of the song Wouldn't It Be Nice, along with our harmonies into Here, There, and Everywhere, the song on the Revolver album. The L.A. native says his take on a piece of Beatles lore that usually mentions another Pet Sounds track, God Only Knows.
Love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you.
You better get upstairs. Lennon and McCartney are waiting for you. Or as Sir Paul McCartney says of the album Pet Sounds in the documentary, "I just thought, dear me, this is the album of all time. What the hell are we going to do?" Pet Sounds is now regarded as one of the greatest albums in musical history. Its creation is, accordingly, a key component of the documentary. Titled simply The Beach Boys, the film features the surviving members, Love and Johnson, as well as Brian Wilson and Al Jardine, plus archive interviews with deceased Wilson brothers Dennis, who drowned in 1983, and Carl, who succumbed to cancer in 1998.
God only knows what I'd be without you.
Having previously made a film about another sibling group, the Bee Gees, 2020's How Can You Mend a Broken Heart, director Frank Marshall sought to explore the DNA kinship that makes for both close harmonies and fractious relations. Unsurprisingly, those resulting dramas are also at the heart of many music films, which is one reason for the genre's current popularity. Documentaries generally, thanks Marshall, are these days much more widely appealing, whereas they used to be sort of taboo because people thought they were history lessons. But now they're entertaining. They're about things that people care about, and to hear how this music was created is interesting to people. In the documentary, a tearful Mike Love says of Brian, "These days we don't really talk much, but if I could, I'd probably just tell him that I love him. And nothing anybody could do could erase that." Marshall's film ends with lovely footage of all the bandmates, including Brian, reunited at Paradise Cove, the Malibu beach where they shot the cover photograph for their 1962 debut album, Surf and Safari. Did Love have the chance on that day to tell Brian he loved them? I didn't say that specifically, but lots of love was in the air. Our family isn't mushy about things, but the love is there in the music and in the camaraderie, and we have far more positive things to appreciate and be thankful for than the negative. The negative existed, but in the now, the potential is positive. So how did you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, who was the very first rock artist to perform at Yankee Stadium? Was that A, Billy Joel, B, the Beatles, C, Elvis Presley, or D, Nirvana? And the correct answer is answer A, Billy Joel. As noted in OnThisDay.com, Billy Joel, back in 1990, became the first rock artist to perform at Yankee Stadium. As noted in the FirstSerenade.com, in June 22 and 23, 1990, Billy Joel and his band played two sold-out concerts at New York's famous Yankee Stadium. It was the perfect marriage of performer and venue. The concerts were recorded and broadcast as a single concert on the Disney Channel, and then later released as a single concert video DVD. The concert DVD was 85 minutes and featured 12 songs. Barnes & Noble's online store describes the DVD as follows. For all his international success, Billy Joel still tends to be identified as a Long Island singer-songwriter, in much the same way that Bruce Springsteen is identified with the Garden State. Joel even began his career with an album entitled Cold Spring Harbor, after a peaceful hamlet on Long Island's North Shore, near his widely reported birthplace, Hicksville. Yet in Billy Joel Live at Yankee Stadium, put together from two sold-out 1990 performances at the house that Ruth built, the multi-platinum superstar says the concerts represented a homecoming to his birthplace, the Bronx. We'll take Joel at his word on the Bronx-born claim, since his considerable gifts for songsmithing clearly draw on the rich doo-wop traditions of the Bronx in the 1950s. One could argue that his music was born there. So it's easy to get into the spirit of the production, which starts with Joel arriving alongside with his fans on the subway and entering the stadium gates alongside appreciative hordes. Once on stage with his band and touring accompanists, though, he's the entertainer, swinging for the fences with spectacular lights and thundering orchestration. Opening with Stormfront, Joel barrels through high-energy hit after hit, pounding the keys of his piano through such favorites as I Go to Extremes and Scenes from an Italian Restaurant, before switching from piano to tempered accordion on Downeaster Alexa. He straps on a guitar for We Didn't Start the Fire, covers the Isley Brothers' classic Shout, and delivers the anthem A Matter of Trust with appropriate vigor. The 13-song set closes with Piano Man, a cozy classic closely identified with his Long Island lounge roots, and somehow before 40,000 or so fans in baseball's most storied stadium, Joel manages homey intimacy. You'd think he was born there. And the answer to our second question, what is the most common sound that we as humans use without our vocal cords? Is it A, hand clapping, B, foot stomping, C, finger snapping, D, nasal snoring, or D, armpit squeezing? Correct answer, answer A, hand clapping. As noted in an article titled, Why Are We Clapping? A History of Applause by Amanda Mehata in theaterinparis.com on the 19th of April, 2018. Some have said that clapping is like high-fiving yourself in a positive response to something that someone else has done. It is the most common sound that we as humans use without our vocal cords. She goes on to add that we do it as a social gesture to show approval and admiration in groups, crowds, or by ourselves, and more so in the setting of being presented with something like a show or a performance. But what is the reason behind why we clap? Did you know that the average speed of our claps ranges from 2.5 to 5 claps per second? The meaning of clapping is recognized through every culture in the world and is one of the most universal means of communication. Let's take a look at the history of applause. In Western etiquette, a study has shown that the clap of an individual actually has very little to do with that individual's personal opinion of the quality of the performance. It has more to do with the feeling of belonging in the group that someone has just experienced something with. Haven't you ever heard someone say that they're just clapping to be polite? Or when you applaud because everyone else is clapping, even if you're not really sure what's going on yourself? Don't worry, we won't tell anyone. In comparison to vocalizing approval through speech, clapping is easier, louder, and more anonymous, especially in crowds. Clapping is even considered more democratic, since stomping your feet can be too disruptive, and not everyone can snap their fingers. Taking it way back to 5th century BC, lawmaker Clisthenes of Athens made it so that audiences would have to clap in approval of their leader, since there were too many people to meet individually. Through this came the applause, the united voices of all these people in the form of clapping together in admiration. A few hundred years later, in the 4th century BC, came the clacker, that's spelled C-L-A-Q-U-E-R. A clacker was a person who was hired by theaters and shows to clap, to cry, or to laugh at the right moments in order to influence the audience's reactions. In the 4th century Athens competition, it was fierce between comedians, and clackers became a common way to sway the decision of the judges and be awarded the best performance. In the Roman Empire, the practice of using applause to influence was applied to politics, and clackers were found in both courts of law and private art demonstrations. Roman Emperor Nero even established a school of applause, with a clack of thousands of knights and soldiers following his concert tours. Clapping history has a unique role in France and French venues as well. In 18th century France, the clack had a strong presence as an organized body of professional applauders and influencers. Continually used in theaters to influence audiences, with the clackers often paid by the production and actors of the play in free tickets. The whole affair was quite organized, with certain clackers applied to laugh loudly during comedic portions, others to shed a tear for a melancholic performance, and even clackers designated to comment their appreciation of a play or speech to fellow audience members. Nowadays, however, the days of the clackers is over, and all you'll find in Parisian playhouses is bona fide applause. We do still find some traces. The remnants of the clackers are now limited to television show sets and radio programs in the form of applause symbols to tell the audience when they should be clapping or even can clapping and laughter. It is interesting to note as well that there are appropriate times and places for every applause. It is considered perfectly normal to applaud a politician as he takes the stage before he even gives a speech, as a sign of approval and in recognition of past accomplishments. In a religious setting, however, applauding is rarely heard. While during a play, it would be deemed rude to begin applauding in the middle of a performance, one often hears clapping throughout an opera in appreciation for a particularly difficult piece of music. Applause can even evolve into higher gestures of approval. Standing ovation, anyone? So it can be said that clapping has now evolved into an expectation and standard of behavior. The act of applause and clapping along with other people following a performance of any kind has become a social norm with a long list of historical influences. And by the way, as it turns out, the one-handed clap, which is a motion with one hand without any sound, therefore, apparently has been used to show disapproval. Thank you. So let's close out today's program with a warm welcome to summer and the beach. Here's Wipeout, which was released today in 1963 by the Safaris. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words: kindness is the language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion to music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information, to make an appointment, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.